my memoirs. Done before the present ones were started a few years ago. And of course, long before Carter. Though Plains is only 90 miles north of Cairo, his experiences parallel mine, mainly in the earlier life of his ancestors, coming from Virginia to Georgia in the 1600s and 1700s. My own father was born in 1855, next to the youngest of 13. Most of my sketch here is about his life after becoming a preacher, going back to his early days as a farmer and his pioneer work as a pecan nurseryman. I will take the things I think you would be most interested in as far as time allows. Let me begin when I moved to the country, 1 mile from Cairo, to a farm of about 200 acres at the age of 6. The town itself was like many of its size, which is about 1,500, around 1910. There were two automobiles in the town, one an EMF roadster driven by a daredevil of the town, and a white Buick, open with two seats and no doors, owned by my own uncle, a wealthy doctor. The strange thing was the fantastics riding down the main street at Christmas, wearing masks and gay clothes, shooting pistols. The two farms that my father bought were on both sides of the Tallahassee Highway, a dirt road that ran to the Crockett River and on from there 35 miles to Tallahassee, the capital of Florida. The old Chester place, they called it, a framed six-room house in the middle of a grove of three magnolia trees and three huge red oak trees. And here begins the excerpts from my memoir. We had no running water, but there was a good well on the back porch, a good three-hole privet about 100 yards from the house, and large metal wash tubs that could be brought into the kitchen for an all-over bath. We could always tell at night there was a large family-sized pot at the head of the stairs between the rooms where we all slept. We could always tell how full the pot was, sometimes who was using it, by the sounds that ranged from a tiny tinkle to a thundering bass. No one was allowed to use the pot for big business unless he was sick or caught short. Then it had to be emptied immediately. As for bathing, we didn't miss it. That was a strict rule that we had to wash our hands and faces before eating, and our feet before going to bed. And this was easily done on the basins in the basins on the back porch. More substantial bathing was taken care of by occasional sponge baths with a washcloth and the inevitable Sunday night tub bath with hot water. The Saturday night baths were a ritual, each child taking his turn in the kitchen. On cold winter nights, the tub was placed as near the kitchen stove as possible, so that one side seemed to be freezing while the other baked in the intense heat of the fat pine lighter in the stove. We were, I believe, a happy family, certainly a united family, held together by Papa's and Mama's devotion to God and to the belief that home is the first place where religious ideas should be shown. I had four brothers and sisters, an older brother and sister and a younger brother and sister, with me an odd one, and in the middle. Our farm lay on both sides of a main road, sometimes called the River Road, because it reached the Crockett River, 7 miles away, and sometimes the Tallahassee Road, because it went on from there to the capital of Florida, 35 miles away. This is now the farm is now all cut up. This is added to what I wrote at that time. The farm is now all cut up and built on as far as the creek swamp on the east and as the hospital on the south. The hospital, we gave the land for that to the hospital authorities, and Later, they built a highway through our property, a paved highway running through the pecan orchard for a new route built to bypass the town. A fairly constant stream of traffic went by our door, and often they stopped under our big red oak tree to let their stock rest and cool off a little. Much traffic went by, especially on Saturday afternoons between the country people went to town to buy gas supplies and swap gossip. Long after my bedtime on Saturday nights, I could hear them going home, the wagon wheels creaking or whip cracking. Usually they went white and colored alike in wagons drawn by two mules, sometimes as many as a dozen or so in one wagon, sitting on boards laid across the side of the wagon body. Occasionally there would be a light one-seat buggy, or a heavier two-seat buggy drawn by horses, but the mules and wagons were much more common. Sometimes more exciting traffic went by. A meat wagon, petting a freshly killed cow, would stop under the red oak, lift the gauge, gauze, and netting that kept the flies off, and cut and weigh you a piece of fresh meat. Better still were the occasional covered wagons bound for the Gulf Coast, 60 miles to the south. Even from way up in middle Georgia, they would come by our house on the way to Tallahassee, from there on down to St. Mark's or Shell Point or Panacea, romantic names that spell excitement to our young minds. Most of these covered wagons belonged to fish peddlers who brought back barrels of salted mullet and mullet rope, which they sold from house to house on the way north. Up near the roof of the wagon was suspended a hammock where one man could sleep while another drove, and under the back of the wagon, a lantern was lit at night. In my second year at school, our whole family went to the coast for a two-week fishing trip. I've since traveled around the world and lived in Japan and Europe. But no later journey compared with that first long trip, the three-day trek, 60 miles to Florida and the Gulf of Mexico. Part of the excitement was from being taken out of school for 2 weeks. Most of it was from the fun of exploring new country, seeing new people, doing new things. As I remember, we had two covered wagons piled high with quilts and tents, fishing tackle, and all sorts of fishing equipment. Mom and cousin Carrie White drove old George hitched to our seat, open seat buggy. But we went on the way at regular camping sites at Ivonia store the first night, a few miles below Tallahassee the second night. We got to Spring Creek, not far from St. Mark's in the Gulf Springs, the afternoon of the third day. Spring Creek was formed from several deep river clear springs that boiled up in the marshes. Actually, it was more than an arm of the Gulf than a stream. Papa took us out in a boat with him over the bridge, springs. We kids hooked some big redfish, and with Papa's help, we managed to get them into the boat. Most fun of all was when we went on expeditions with Old Man Griner, a native fisherman. He took us out to the oyster bars to grapple for oysters in the deeper water with long tongs. He took us to a nearby point of land to get dry cedar wood for camp cooking. Cedar gives out no smoke, besides it was plentiful. At Shell Point, we kids loved to watch the mullet fishermen at work. One man climbed to the top of a pole where he could sit and watch schools of mullet swimming in the fairly shallow water along the beach. When he gave a signal, a boat with long nets attached to it started rowing vigorously up to cut the fish off in deep water. When the fish had been beached, been headed off, the boat went for the shore and was quickly pulled in by 20, 30 men on the beach. Then came the payoff. Once there was nothing in there but one cowfish. Another time, however, there would be hundreds of mullet who were flung on the long tables where sharp knives cut off their heads and gutted them. The large roe in pairs and often as big as half a fish was carefully cut out, put in separate barrels. Mullet and roe were then packed in barrels with salt to be shipped out. These were the highlights of our 2 weeks at the coast. There are other vivid memories. There was a steep hill right in the town of Tallahassee where you seemed to go right from the red hills and live oaks down to the sand flats that stretch all the way to within a few miles of the coast. flat, barren country where only scrub oaks and low palmetto bushes would grow. There were numerous sinkholes fed by underground streams. Glad you don't see that today, because it's not there. A few memories last from this trip, the greatest trip of my life, really. White lighthouse shining in the sun across the water at St. Mark's. The nets drying on large reels by the shore. The long-legged white birds that flew up from the salt marshes. The light of our neighbor's campfires splitting the darkness. The smell of wood fires and fish frying. The trip to Spring Creek was the most dramatic event of my young life. For as a rule, ours was a well-ordered household. Mama was very busy looking after a large family with very little help. Papa was busy making a living for us. As we got big enough, each of us children was busy with the lessons always or with work. We found plenty of time to play, but all of us were brought up to work regularly before the playtime began. We had to keep the kitchen wood box full and in winter bring in coal for the big living room heater. We had to help feed and water the stock, which in our time, in our barn, consisted of a whole horse, Old George, and four or five cows and calves. After that evil day, when I accepted the quarter for learning to milk, I had to help milk the cow. There was always something to do, be done around the farm, wood to split, water to draw, animals to be fed, chicken houses to be cleaned out. One of my jobs was to draw water from the farm well and pour it into a funnel, in which it went by gravity through a pipe to the water trough in the cow lot about 100 feet away. This farm well is about 60 feet deep, supplied by wonderful springs that later furnished water for our new house. In the early days, however, it was an open well with a shaft about 4x4, wooden curbing that began near the water. Once I had to help rescue a cat that fell in the well, hid for days on the curbing way below. When I drew up the bucket with the cat in it, the poor creature was mad with hunger and exposure, bit me through my wool gloves. The cat was killed, and its head sent to Atlanta to be examined for hydrophobia. The test was positive, and I had to go to Uncle Willie's hospital 21 times for injections of Pasteur treatment. Drawing water from a well was a sort of game for me. I loved to watch the bucket go down until it splashed and went under, then up the drops, making a tinkling round sound as they spilled down the deep shaft. On summer days about noon, the shadows on the water deep in the well were lovely, especially when you let the bottom of the bucket gently splash on top of the water and send out ripples for the well curbing. I would stand there and watch the sunlight play on the ripples. Many times, Mama called me from my daydreaming at the well to come to dinner. But in winter, I worked fast, for it was cold, and I could always tell just how cold by the thickness of the sheet of ice on the water trough in the cow lot. There was always plenty of play as well as work. Even after we started to work regularly in the fields, it was in summer a two-hour break when it was too hot to work in the fields, but not too hot to play baseball in the driveway under the red oaks, or to walk to the swimming hole below Muggers' mill on the little tired creek nearly a mile away, to stay in the cold water for half an hour or so, walk back in time for work. When I was still pretty young, about 9 or 10, I think, we built a new house, the big one that burned long after I left home. It was a new house, two-story house, with four large white columns in the traditional Southern colonial manner. It was Papa's dream house that he got that he had long promised Mama to compensate for all the moving around she had done as an itinerant minister's wife. The house was beautiful and white against the dark, glossy green of the magnolia leaves. It had two bathrooms and, like city houses, five large bedrooms, a huge reception hall, a cozy living room, also used as a study in his Papa's office, a spacious dining room, a kitchen with a butler's pantry, and a screened back porch. Front porches extended under all four columns on both floors. The upper one, little used except for sunning things, but the lower one, furnished with rocking chairs and a wide swing at either end, served as a summer living room. There were lots of room under the roof or attic, Over the central portion, we put flooring and used it to store trunks to play in on rainy days. Our new house became a dream house of us all, and in it I spent my best childhood years. Papa built the house himself, hiring a master carpenter at $5 a day to follow the blueprints of the architect who had designed it. The whole cost was about $5,000, but it could easily have doubled that if Papa had not closely supervised every step of the construction. Slowly, slowly, it seemed to me, the new house took form, and the four large white columns were maneuvered into place. The bathtubs and toilets were installed. The new cypress water tank was hauled up to the top of a 60-foot scaffold. The pipes were connected, and the water ran through the pipes into the bathtubs and toilets, wash basins and the sinks, one in the kitchen and one in the butler's pantry, and into the hot water tank by the kitchen stove. And when the water ran, the cycle was complete. The new house was done, and we moved in. I tell you, we lived in style. Papa and Mama had a room of their own. Margaret and Cresha had a room. Joe and I had a room. And Walter had a room all his own until he asked Ralph Dorman, the superintendent, to share it with him. And yet the bedroom downstairs, with a dressing room of its own and an adjoining bath, was kept for a guest room. For every southern house has a guest room if possible. Ours was frequently used by visiting preachers, relatives, and friends. For 3 winters, it was rented to a northern family, the Gibsons, from Far Rockaway, Long Island, who came down ostensibly to look after the pecan grove across the creek they had bought from Papa. Won't tell more about them in a moment. But one of my jobs was to get up in the morning before anyone else, dress in the freezing room, run downstairs to build a fire in the kitchen stove, then start coal fires in the living room, in Papa's and Mama's bedroom, where everybody else dressed in turn, finally, in the Gibsons' bedroom. Those who think South Georgia is a warm climate should try this routine for a while. I have since been through many sub-zero spells in Korea, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Minnesota. But my most vivid memories of cold are from Georgia, walking to school, facing the north wind, getting up winter mornings to build fires in a cold house. My wife says that's because I didn't dress properly, but that's all. Our family life changed little from year to year, regardless of what house we lived in or who came or went. A distinctly religious atmosphere was always there, and every day we had family prayer. When I was still quite small, we changed from prayer at bedtime in the living room, kneeling in our chairs, to prayer just before supper with our heads bowed as we sat around the dining room table. Mama had found out that we were apt to be sleepy at bedtime, so we had prayers at supper instead of the customary blessing that preceded all meals. Just before evening prayer, everyone in turn had to recite a verse from the Bible. Then Papa or Mama, and in later years, whatever child Papa designated, offered a prayer, which usually took the form of thanking God for blessings and asking his guidance for the future. I learned to have a great respect for Papa as a preacher. The fact that he was superannuated meant merely that people without close church connections who were too poor to pay for a regular minister could call on him for weddings, funerals, and even preaching. The rules of the church allowed him no pension unless he could show that he was in distress. The fact that he had given the best years of his life to the regular minister didn't seem to matter. We preached for poor country churches which had no minister. And as his reputation spread, he was asked to go all over Greater County to bury people or to preach. The ones who wanted to get married, usually in a hurry, came to him. He was known to all as Preacher Jones, addressed by black and white alike as Brother Jones. I used to go with him in the early days, sometimes going in our open buggy 8 to 10 miles before time for the 11 o'clock service. We went to country churches to preach. We were naturally invited to some members' home for dinner. Country people tried to outdo themselves for the preacher, so we had a sample of almost everything in their weekly fare served up to us in the one meal. There was always chicken in some form, and country ham, baked or fried. There were usually biscuits and other hot bread, sweet potatoes, greens, and other vegetables in season, rice or grits, cake and pie. Once there was an additional large platter, piled high, with about 20 fried eggs. Soon after dinner, we would start home in order to get back in time to feed the stock before supper. Although as far as I know, he never received a penny for it, Papa would preach his heart out to these simple country folks. He gave his best that they loved him for it. Many times they came from many miles around to get him to come bury their dead. Now that I look back upon it, I can understand why. They could feel his genuine sympathy. Not content with reading the ritual of the church, Papa talked to the people at the open grave as if they were his brothers and sisters, as if he were buried his own mother or father. No wonder he had worn himself out at the age of 46, to spend much nervous energy constantly day in and day out, without physical recuperation would wear down the strongest heart. Sometimes Papa would be the guest preacher at an all-day singing and tenor on the ground. I once wrote a story about this, but it never got published. It is true that the preaching is a poor second to the singing in interest when a country church has its all-day sing, but it's still an honor to be asked to preach during one of the interludes in singing. By the time we got to the church for preaching about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, the woods would be full of buggies and wagons. Nearly every tree near the church would have a horse or mule tied to it. To me, the big part about all they sang was a dinner on the ground, when all families opened up their baskets and brought out fried chicken and baked ham, fried sausages, peach pickle, pound cake, and all sorts of good things to eat. After a big dinner, folks would go back to their singing while we started on the long ride home. Papa went all over the county to bury folks and to preach, but the couples who wanted to be married usually came to him. Occasionally, he would officiate at a regular church wedding where there were family fancy clothes and music and flowers. Much more often, a couple would come to our house. Sometimes they would come into the house, and then after the ceremony, Mama would offer to bring out refreshments, some cake and a pitcher of blackberry shrub, or so some other temperance drink. But a good many of them wouldn't budge from their buggies or in later years their cars, and Papa would marry them by the side of the road. Sometimes the groom gave Papa a dollar or two. On rare occasions, as much as $5. More often, he would offer nothing or sheepishly mumble something about paying some other time. Whatever Papa got for weddings went straight to Mama by long-standing agreement. It was the only extra money our household ever got, and it was not much. Our family always took an active part in the local church. Papa often preached there when I was young. Many years he conducted the adult Bible class at Sunday school. On Communion Sundays, the first Sunday in each month, Papa would go behind the altar and help the minister with the service. Frequently he was called on for the long prayers that turned out to be short, fiery sermons, not so short, whose fervor reached the heights of his grandeur. As a child, all but the passionate fervor went out over my head. But later I could see in Papa's public prayers in church the one proper outlet for that deep poetic strain that all his life had been sublimated in service to God. On these occasions, the poet in him had free rein, and with him his listeners could feel something of the glory of his God, who rode in the whirlwind while the morning stars sang together for joy. Papa's God was always an inspired vision. The most exciting part of our family religious life was going every summer, many years, to do the two-week camp meeting in Indian Springs. Papa and Mama helped run the big hotel, and that was a big job for even their smooth-running team. Every year in August, people of the church gathered at the campground near Indian Springs from all over Georgia and other states for 2 weeks of high-pressure evangelistic services. In the huge tabernacle opened at the sides, services of some kinds were being held all day from sunrise to midnight. At least three times a day, fiery sermons were preached to packed audiences. Thousands were exhorted to hit the glory trail, down the aisles, carpeted with straw or sawdust, down to the raw rail near the pulpit. Most of the people who came every year to camp meetings had their own summer cottage or rented one, but for others there was a large hotel, a rambling three-story building of unpainted pine. The hotel was run by Brother Myers, and for many years Papa went regularly to help him. Mama went to help Papa, for no we children went for the ride, but we were too little to help much. All we got out of it was our expenses, but the trouble was more than compensated for Mom and Papa by the privilege of occasionally attending meetings, and for us children by the excitement of it all. Until I was about 12, it was a high point of every summer to go to Indian Springs. I found it very exciting. Train ride on the local day coach with coal smoke and cinders, three places to change cars, basket lunch on the train, the 3 mile ride from Flo Villa, the last stop on the main line, to the campground on the miniature railroad known as the Dummy, with a tiny engine and a small open car, crowds of people at the campgrounds, and the occasional trips to the fashionable hotel and casino at the nearby resort of Indian Springs. That's where the rich people went. I was too young, even in the last years we went, to be much impressed by the fiery exhorting of the preachers, or by the emotional pleas of the workers. But I remember there was much praying, not only at the large semicircular altar rail near the pulpit, but also in the benches where mourners knelt all over the tabernacle and in the rooms of cottages there around the ground. But I love the I love the crowds and the air of excitement, the festive music that poured from the huge improvised orchestra and choir on the platform behind the pulpit, and most of all, the circus atmosphere of the tabernacle with its open sides, its straw-filled aisles, and at night, its glaring gas torches. I also wrote a story about this, but it didn't get published either. I've written more stories that didn't get published than anything else. My scholarly books were all easy to publish, thanks to Howard. But my stories never did, even though I had a very good agent in New York, Nanny and Joseph, who tried very hard to publish them, but they just didn't go. There's only two places, Scribner's and Atlantic, that would publish them, and they just didn't get around to it. Now, I loved the good food that Mom and Mrs. Myers provided for the hotel guests. At noon, the tables would overflow and be reset and again overflow, and even with the help of dozens of cooks and waitresses and dishwashers, the place was a madhouse from about 12 to 2 every day. The pool was plentiful and the guests were numerous and hungry. Never before or since have I seen such eating, not even at a family reunion barbecue. In the early morning, the farmers used to come to the hotel from their nearby farms with their wagons piled high with vegetables and fruit and wire coops filled with live chickens. As I remember, the hotel served fried chicken every day for the 2 weeks of the camp meeting. At any rate, there was scarcely a morning that chickens were not being killed and picked and got ready for the noon dinner. Table after table of hungry people were fed, and still they came. They ate fried chicken with the same zest that they listened to the preaching and praying. When they went away, they were no longer hungry. To a child's eye, these people were most of them lovable and kind folks, not strange religious freaks. They loved a good time and excitement like other people, but during the camp meeting, religion was their excitement. Now I've got to go a little close, a little slower, and tell just a little bit about the pecan nursery business, because that's what made my father's money. Paper shell pecan industry was in its early growing stages in the South at that time, when Papa got into it soon after we moved to the farm. First, he began cautiously as a partner of cousin Byron White, one of the pioneers in improved varieties of pecans. Incidentally, the White nursery now is one of the largest in the country there in Kiro. But not long afterwards, and certainly about the time I began to work regularly in the fields, that is around 1912, he bought the White interest in the partnership. White and Jones became Magnolia Nursery, Orchard and Farm. We grew no magnolias, only pecan trees, but we had named our place the huge flowering trees around our house. The name of the place was given to the growing nursery business. We three boys were taught to work, and we worked in the fields from the age about 10 on during in the summertime. And we went from The lowest price, minimum wage, was 25 cents a day. Up to the highest wages of the hall, $2.50 a day. Because we were told that we had to earn the money. This money was not a gift, but we banked it every Saturday in the local bank, and we were to use it to pay our first year of college. The nursery business was fairly easy once you've learned it. In those days, it was far more lucrative than ordinary farming. But our families came at a time when we needed it most. Not only did the profits take care of the growing needs of a large family, but was more important, enabled Papa to send all five children to college and us three boys to expensive postgraduate professional schools as well. It took all we could possibly squeeze out of the business, out of the development of a large pecan grove across the creek, which Papa sold to Mr. Gibson for a good profit. When I got my PhD degree at Harvard in 1927, to end the drain on the family resources, our farm had what looked like a hopeless debt on it. It was really tremendous. $8,000. But ironically, it was insurance from our burned home that paid for it. This was, to go on very rapidly, we would package trees and set them off regularly during the winter time. Saturday mornings, we boys worked in that field, so we knew how it was done. We put the trees in bundles that could be convenient to handle, and I varied from about 10 large 8 to 10 foot trees to 35 or 40 small 1 to 2 foot trees. They all paid for by the side, of course. Roots were wrapped in small, moist sphagnum moss from our swamp and tied compactly together. Then the whole bundle, roots to the tip of the longest limb, was sewed in gunny sacks. We called them crocus sacks in those days. Bought it from the local people. Each day we loaded the tow horse wagon with tagged bundles and sent them to the express office at railroad station in Cairo. Plenty of time to get them off on the eastbound 10 o'clock or the westbound 1 o'clock train. Many times I've seen a whole express car filled with bundles of pecan trees from ours in the white nurseries in Cairo. As you can see, this is quite a business for a broken down Methodist minister to build up from nothing. He managed it all, including the clerical work, such as advertising, business correspondence, and bookkeeping, every piece of it in longhand and without any help. Pecans were our main crop. We had a sizable two-horse farm in addition to the nursery. We grew sugar cane, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, and enough corn, peanuts. We didn't call them peanuts, we called them pendants in those days. They've learned now to call them, since Mr. Carter is growing them, call them peanuts. Oats and hay to feed one horse, three mules, 8 or 10 head of cattle, anywhere from 50 to 100 hogs. In the old days, I'll pick up the pieces here with the sugar cane grinding. In the old days, the syrup was cooked in a large kettle, but even when I was still a boy, the kettle on most farms around Cairo had been replaced by a long evaporator pan. Cooking syrup in a kettle was a long and laborious process, for the whole kettle had to be cooked down to syrup before any juice could be added. When the syrup was judged to be ready, it had to be dipped out until the kettle was empty. Then the kettle had to be cleaned out and new juice poured in to start a new kettle of syrup. With evaporators, the process is continual. Juice comes in as needed from the spigot at one end of the long pan, goes slowly up and down the narrow partitions, finally comes out as syrup at a spigot or at the other end, ready to go into barrels or cans or into the pint beer bottle, so handy for personal use. In both processes, as soon as the juice begins to boil, the impurities rise to the surface and are skimmed off. Skimmings are usually fed to the hogs, but there have been times when they were allowed to ferment a potent drink known as buck, drawn from the barrel. Now when I ride along the road, smell the delicately sweet steam that rises from the evaporator, or at night see the light of the furnace door, or a flaring pine torch through the white sugar steam, I feel a sharp nostalgic twinge. I can remember feeding the cane into the grinder and watching the juice spurt as the stalk cracked. I can remember skimming the juice as it boiled. I can remember the nip in the fall air and the warmth of the furnace under the pan as the sparks fell in the fall air, the warmth of the furnace under the pan as the sparks fell in the pumping pot. Most of all, I remember the delicate sweetness, the sugar steam, and the whiteness of it through the light. After all the cane was ground and made into syrup, we watched for the first cold snap for hog killing. By this time, our grove of hogs had rooted up all the penders, cleaned up what was left after gathering corn and sweet potatoes. Most of the animals had gone into the fields in August or September at 75 to 100 pound shoats. We're now double that weight or more. If we kept them any longer, we would have to feed them in precious corn that was in the crib, which was being saved for our cornmeal and grits, regular mule feed for carrying over the brood sows and small pigs until the next winter. But in South Georgia, you had to have a good cold snap to kill hogs, or your meats might spoil before it could be salted away. So we watched anxiously, and when there was a promise of freeze as the night came on, unless the next day was Sunday, Papa got ready for hog killing. He had all the pigs, except those to be carried over, driven into the cow lot. When I say driven, you don't need to drive a pig, you just tow him along by putting down grains of corn ahead of him. He sent word to all the neighbors up and down the road to come help the next morning. And they were there too, about 75 or 100 of them. By daylight the next day, a big fire was already going under the big sugar kettle to serve as a scalding pan. After the pig was shot or stunned with an axe, then stuck in the throat for bleeding, the carcasses were dragged to the big kettle and scalded. They were turned on both sides in the steaming water, tested with a hoe to see if the hair was ready to come off. On the far side, they were dragged onto an old barn door where the hair was scraped off until the pig was gleaming white. One by one, the white carcasses were hung head down on a long pole. It's no easy job to maneuver a 200-pound hog, so the pointed stick thrust through the tendons of both hind feet went over the log and held him securely. On this scaffolding, the pigs were gutted and left to cool. Later in the day, they were taken down and carried over to the cutting bench, where Papa usually cut them up. The old-fashioned way of cutting was to cut out the backbone and eat it fresh. Since that was wasteful, when we killed 50 hogs or more at one time, Papa sawed the backbone in two and left half of it with all the ribs to be cured up as side meat. The good cuts, ham, shoulders, and sides, went to the salting bench from there into our cold storage. Papa had one of the first cold storages for meat in that section, a massive, thick wall structure right in the old smokehouse. As a consequence, we never had any spoiled meat, even though the weather frequently turned warm within a day or two after salt hog killing. All the ham, shoulders, sides, bacon, and heads were salted away to be cured and smoked. The heads were split open, the teeth and palate removed, the brains saved to be eaten fresh as a great delicacy. I will have to pass over rather hurriedly some of the memories of the early days, but I have to give you one of them, two of them. In the summer I had a ground itch. You know what a ground itch is? It's where the hookworm goes into the skin and makes your foot itch. Summer I had ground itch so bad it covered both legs to the knee with festering blisters, and I had to keep my legs bathed in a tub of ice water. How I would drown the gnats when I let them collect on my legs and then suddenly dip them into the water. Or the time I took the hookworm treatment, beginning with Epsom salts one evening and no food until supper the next day. How good the scrambled eggs tasted that night when I was allowed to eat. I'll have to stop. this point, and you can ask me questions, but don't expect any good answers. Because they